You are listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois, streaming online at weft.org.
Elliott Counseling Group has been providing compassionate mental health care to the community for nearly 20 years. Elliott Counseling Group offers counseling and behavioral health medication support and management to children, adolescents, and adults of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Tarleton, Mattoon, and surrounding communities, with visits currently held both in person and via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Please consider supporting the programming you love. WEFT will gladly accept that vehicle you've been looking to get rid of. Our vehicle donation program provides an effortless option to support WEFT Community Radio. You can give CARS, that's the Charitable Adult Rides and Services, a call at 855-500-RIDE or fill out the secure donation form at careeasy.org. Just remember to designate WEFT as the nonprofit beneficiary of your gift. WEFT truly appreciates supporters like you.
This is Dave Unk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. And we've been working with St. Joe a little bit. Kirby has been out there, and we've been checking out the sites. She is very interested in getting rid of invasive species, and she'd like to have the stewards out there helping him. So she is a very physical person and enjoys the work, but she also enjoys knowing how it fits. And she's had a lot to do with creating a large prairie on the Sangamon River. And we have debates about these places and what happens. And so this week she was going to take out about 9 or 10 people to the what we call a policeman's road. I think we should have a better name for that. But the policeman's road was created because there's a road that goes around to an area. Policemen have to know how to shoot, and so sometimes there's a range in a place. Sometimes they just have to be relaxed. And so sometimes police organizations have cottages where you can escape the world and be friends in a different way. So the road we're talking about is a spin-off from Route 150. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But Elizabeth called back to say that she had been there with 9 people, and she knows most of them, and they were glad to get information. So I'm going to be a little bit more expansive with today's event, because actually prairie is not, it's our heritage. It's the land and biota that given us our wealth, but for 6 generations we've been getting rid of it, and it tends to have weeds coming in from around it, and that includes trees that are on the weedy side. So it's always helpful to have a little bit of history in your background to tell people what settlers had to do. St. Joe provides an ideal spot for a lot of different things. Champaign County was very wet, one of the most wet counties in Illinois. And when settlers came, they thought, because of their experience in Europe, they liked trees, and they thought prairies were infertile because they didn't grow a tree. They very shortly found out that that was not the case. The prairies were much more fertile, actually. You have to know something about the overall modification across the country to understand what happens. There has been, over the millennium, kind of a battle between forest and prairie. And it depends a lot on climate changes over the years. And that is happening now a little, and we've got great concern. Humans have modified it some, but over millions of years, prairies have established themselves. They had to retreat when glaciers came south. And so they persist in areas where the soil is not quite so good. There are two types of soils that we encounter. First of all, there's a bedrock, or the basic soil, on the continental subplain. It had rivers, and they would cut in and cause valleys. And so there was a landscape underneath our present landscape. It was augmented by glaciation. And the glaciers came down and stood in certain places where the climate was stable, and they might have been there for 10,000 years or whatever. It might have been a shorter time. If you're a person who studies glaciers, you have to know that the one that's 50 miles south might be older than the one that's 50 miles north, and according to the different glacial periods, you're going to get different moraines. That's where a glacier sits and melts and drops the rock and rubble that's in it. And if that glacier is coming from rich territories that might be rich in calcium and limestone and things like that, and rich in a variety of rocks and geology, then you're bringing rich material to the Midwest. There were uprisings. There was the Rocky Mountains and further west, Sierra Madre, and that caused movements in the wind. When you have something that's high and the wind is blowing moisture across the Pacific and it rises gently, it reaches a point where the rain can condense into ice and fall out of a cloud as rain. Now, if it does that, it's going to have a rain shadow on the other side of the mountain, on the east side of the mountain. Then there's going to be a gradual pickup, dry prairie, loose prairie, perhaps, and you have another rise. The dark Rocky Mountains, and you're going to have the same sort of rain shadow. Well, then you're going to get a shortish prairie where there are sort of very damp prairies and medium prairies and sort of dry area prairies. So just on the east side of the Rockies, the prairie will be very short. And further east, it gets to be a mid-prairie. And further east again, it gets to be a tall grass prairie. The prairies just didn't evolve on these soils. The prairies were at other places. You have prairies that are named after some of their resources. New England aster, for instance, probably was detected as becoming from New England. Something like cordgrass comes from the damper areas to the south. So you have to know that not only is there this sort of west to east horizontal level, but you have small mountains, so that as you go up the mountain, you're going to get drier prairies because of the drainage. And then you add to this rainfall coming up from the Gulf. So understanding the rainfall patterns is important, and also knowing the dryness of winds. If you have dry winds, you're going to have a dry prairie. And the plant that grows 4 feet high on a damp area is going to grow 10 inches high on a so you have this vertical sorting out of the environment. So you just don't get tall grass prairie in one place and short grass prairie in another place. The forests are interesting. Forest trees have deep roots. Some of them are fibrous, they go east and west, especially where they have friends and relatives and they're protected from the winds. Some of them have very deep tap roots. They could even go into the aquifers and get water when there's a drought. Cottonwoods can do that. But the trees have always been there, depending on going back millions of years. There's been times when there has been more moisture. Trees with those tap roots and their fibrous roots are very deep rooted and they need water. Prairie, on the other hand, is full of thousands of roots. Some of them tap roots, some of them fibrous roots, and they can, a big blue stem might be able to move 4 feet in one direction and 4 feet in another direction. So you have a very strong sod, and it is hard for a prairie tree to get to grow in that sod. So there's this sort of competition. And where you find trees, you don't find the litter that comes with a prairie. So every prairie has a deep soil, which is fibrous and well aerated and rich in soil. Part of that soil comes from a loess. A loess is a wind-blown aeolian soil that moves across the country when the ice cap has moved back. Many of the Midwest soils are covered by loess. They might be covered by 200 feet of loess where there was a deep valley, and they may be only a few inches deep. You have to sort of do your soil mapping, and sometimes University of Illinois is famous for Cyril Hopkins, who came here after being rejected by federal agricultural people he wanted to do mapping, and he wanted to map these soils, and he wanted to map them deeply so that you just didn't get a what was on the top. You got a profile, a soil profile. And Sir Earle Hopkins was accepted at the University of Illinois and became famous for doing early mapping. And that mapping continues today with tractors that are the size of a house and have a television set and a computer, and they can detect sandy soil or deep loam soil. The prairies for millennia have been growing quickly, high. They are fairly drought resistant to that wind that comes across the country. Their leaves will roll to accept that route. They die, but most of their activity is underground, and most of the insects and bacteria and fungi and protea are in the soil. So they have that sort of strength. They're going to survive by dint of the fact that they're underground. The forests, on the other hand, are above ground, and they drop leaves, but they don't drop many leaves. So if you're in a forest soil, you're likely to have a more clay soil, a less fibrous soil, a soil with less humus. We have very, very few prairie soils left. They're our gold. Not everyone knows that, but this is what gave us our wealth. When we were colonials and religious people and people with entrepreneurial objectives, we went into that resource and took it over. And so we have very few of these soils left. And we have one very characteristic area just west of St. Joe, which has these characteristics. And it's probably been mown some, but it's there. Well, so you get that sort of general overlook. You may want to do that in a seminar, but it's kind of fun to do it out in the field. So Elizabeth and her crew was going to go to the policeman's road. And I was invited, but then I was uninvited because it was felt that I had too much passion to be introducing people simply to removing some trees. And that may be true, but what we need to do is have people out there who know enough about the landscape and the history and the biota to be able to stimulate their stewards. And from those stewards, we find some people who will want to be removing invasive species like Liz has done massively, or they may be wanting to be academic prairie people who look for a certain orchid and find out its behavior. They spend their lives doing that. Or they might be an entomologist who will follow a prairie cicada and know when it arrives and how long it survives and then goes back into the ground. They will have people that have interest in bumblebees, and they'll have to know the difference between a bumblebee and an Italian bee, which is introduced. So it's in effect an invasive species, but that's where we get our honey. The bumblebee is not so willing to provide us with a comb that can be spun, and the honey can be centrifuged it out of it, and the cocoon can be put back, and the bees will continue to work. Bumblebees do produce honey, but they find a little nest in trash or whatever. And they're a different cat, but they actually are good pollinators because they have very strong shoulders, and they can get into a closed gentian, for instance, where a regular Italian bee can't get there. So Elizabeth had fun talking to people and telling them about the corridor, and that's perfect because when we get to be specialists, it's often very helpful if you can go to be invited to a school classroom, but not to be a god that knows everything. It should be that your teaching experience should be more or less a learning process, a discovery. And the person who is in charge is the person who knows the student and knows the people, and if it's a stewardship situation, they get to know what the interests are and how interested the people are. Sometimes some people only want to do one or two volunteer efforts a year. Other people would like to do more than that. Some people want to be committed to life. Some people are retirees looking for another job which is very different from the job that they took over or for use for their life. So it is for most of us who are involved in these processes, it's often the second and third level people who do a lot of the hack work in helping people to understand whatever it is that they're doing. It's sometimes a little unfortunate because you might become the CEO or the chief executive officer, and you have to organize the field trips. You have to know the history. You have to have a map cabinet. You have to have people who will organize volunteers. So you get to be away from your prairie that you might be enjoying. But you should have to be out there too. You have to be talking to the neighbors. You have to be talking to the state. Department of Transportation was on a road. The Department of Natural Resources, if it's in a place where there are endangered species or endangered habitats. We're having a real problem at the Rockford Airport at the moment. I think it's Land Use Company. I'm not sure which one is taking out a legal document to prevent the gravel prairie there from being exterminated for a runway. There are engineers who feel that you can just dig up these plants and put them somewhere else. Not so. These plants are adapted to gravel, and there are pockets of gravel all around, but when you get down to the last pocket of gravel that has been is going to be utilized, then people wake up and decide that this is worth saving, and it is worth saving. It went from 25 acres to 14 acres, and now it is looking to go even less. So the court case is being taken out to try and preserve this prairie in its habitat. And so Liz realizes this, and she's had a lot to do with putting together what must be about, I would guess, 30 acres of prairie. I asked her where the site came from. It was farmland, and it was probably a donation. I don't know. I need to check that out. But that's the sort of thing that happens, and you have to put back the prairie. That's so hard to do. When you farm the prairie, the first few years you have 6 inches of really rich humus, and then you have 4 feet of modest humus. You have a soil profile that has air in it, it has moisture in it, and it is available for cultivation for just a few years. And you burn up that humus. And that's kind of cruel because it took millions of years or thousands of years to put together. In this case, nearby, you could probably say that this prairie has been present for 10,000 years. In when you go to put it back, you've taken away all that topsoil and that humus, and you've created a hard base for your corn and soybeans, and you have to provide some of the food that would have naturally come out of the prairie. If you have bought a retired railroad and you have removed the ballast, the prairie soil is there. And if you put in rows of corn, the corn that's in the field will be 10 inches lower than the corn growing in the humus. So we have really taken over our prairies, and they're not going to come back. You'll save a few things. I talked last week about Kew Gardens and the attempt to save seed and plants from around the world. But they also are very careful to if the climate is appropriate or greenhouses are appropriate, to let people know what they would have looked at. We have photography, we have poetry, and we have women were sad to see their prairie dug up because it flowers, and it does interesting things in the spring with starry-eyed grass and cattails and pussy toes and other plants, hyacinths and liliaceous things, and they have in the library at the University of Illinois gobs and gobs of information about prairies, but not so much photography, because you had to, if you were going out in 1850s to do photography, you were going to go out to have a vehicle and a heavy camera, and it was a hard shoot. You had to have a glass slide with a sensitive material on it, and it had to be kept in the dark, and it had to be slid into a camera that was large and heavy, and it had to be supported on a tripod that was substantial because this is soft soil. And you had to take a photograph, and it was probably in black and white. And you had to come back to the dark room and process that picture. And you don't have to do that anymore, but it's not there for the taking. You can get little pieces here and there, and that's good to have restorations. But when you can encounter a remnant, you cherish it. It's the gold of this community. And many people don't realize that because it does look like the weeds they've been removing for years. The definition of a weed is a plant growing out of place. And that prairie growing on a railroad line or in a cemetery reserve property is growing out of place. It just really doesn't belong. It's corn and soybean territory, a little bit of wheat and oats in between. The oats have sort of disappeared some because you don't have to feed horses. And, okay, so Elizabeth was on the remnant prairie at St. Joe, and she wrote me afterwards to say that she was pleased that they were there and do that again. But if I were to take people there, one of the first things I would do is to go to the Policeman's Road, and where it bends around and over the ballast for the railroad, I'd take them east to the bridge over the Salt Fork. And that bridge was a very recent bridge. It was a very good railroad bridge. But on it, there were ties, and people didn't exactly respect this tie. When the railroad retired, they would have picnics on the bridge and burn ties. And so we went there, and we put in ties between the ties so people wouldn't freak out. And it was interesting to note that people who were watching us work with the bridge, and that tended to bring a lot more respect. The high school kids and grade school kids that used to use the little forest that was there began to help us. And that's how you get to do these things. That's how the Grand Prairie Friends has gotten to do things, is to introduce people to jobs that they can do, and then they get become interested in the water or the insect or what have you. So standing on that bridge, you can look north and you can see where the huge meander that went through the west side of St. Joe has been cut. And you can imagine that to do that, they would start with a pond on the Salt Fork, and you put a pontoon into it and a crane on the pontoon, and a grab crane, which is sort of going to, as if you put your hands together and we're going to grab a bundle of grass. You grab a bundle of soil and you put it into a levee, and you straighten out that river so it doesn't take so much time for the river to bend around. So there's a fall between the river at one end and the other end. So that you can see from a distance, you can see where the spoil that was taken out to allow this pontoon to move down and create a straightened river. So we put levees out on the banks, and that was helpful for farmers because that lowland behind the levee was worked for corn and soybeans and pasture, and this prevented it from being flooded. And if it got local water, you had a pump. It was usually a rotary pump that gradually took the water out of the behind the levee area and put it into the river, so you could grow a crop of corn. You can't do that these days because the little plots that were there were okay for a single horse and a plow, but they're not good for a house-sized tractor. That if it goes in there, it's going to get bogged, and then if you pull a bulldozer in to pull it out, you've got to get the bulldozer bogged. And so it's a modern invention that doesn't get into the areas behind the levee, but it makes the river run straight. Rivers don't really run straight. Yeah. Anything that has pressure on it, if you take a bar and squeeze it at both ends, it will form a sigmoid curve. Well, you have a river that's having a hard time going down fast at one end, and then you've got pressure on the other end, and it's like that piece of steel. It's going to bend in a sigmoid manner. And the road you're standing on, the railroad bridge you're standing in, is more or less going into St. Joe where there was a node and there was less movement. Doesn't mean to say that there's no movement. That node will gradually over 1,000 years move downstream. But in the short time, the node is less likely to erode. If you put a house on the node, it's less likely to be destroyed if you have a 10-inch flood. So you're standing there looking north. You're looking down into the water. If it's rainfall and you're following it, the water will be muddy with topsoil that humus and whatever is going down the river and going into the Gulf. And one of these years, a new generation will find there'll be an uplift and we'll have rich soil in the Gulf. But at the moment, it's a real problem to have dead zones in the Gulf, because not only soil that goes down, there's fertilizer too, and all the herbicides and insecticides and what have you. So you're looking at the cutoff, and it begins to meander. So you can see where the soil is making its meanders. So that's good for people to see. It's good for them to see the levee and to know that this is what happens to the water. If this is on a clear day and there's no erosion, it's not a time when people are plowing their land for corn and soybeans at the end of the year, or if it's no-till at the beginning of the year, the water is so clear that you can see the fish, and people fish off that bridge. So your volunteers are getting an idea that there was a bridge with railroad ties. They've been replaced by prefabricated units of a rail trail with sides so that you don't fall off that bridge and hurt yourself. But it's open enough that you can see through the wires. You can see the big meander to the north. You can see that the lowlands that used to be flooded easily being planted to native species that belong to that area, and that will be a natural area in the future. There's a parking lot there. You can go and look and enjoy it. So when you turn around now, you're looking west, and you see the three corridors, the interurban, the main line, and the policeman's road, which is was the highway. And so it's good for people to conceptualize that, because they don't exactly realize that there were three corridors and how they fitted in. The railroad came first. I don't know when it came in. Probably was in the late 1850s. There was native prairie there, and people weren't settled yet, or weren't settled a lot. They would have settled on the rivers, because they would come up the rivers from the south or down the rivers from the north. And people like Joliet would find settlements, Indian settlements, that were near to the rivers. They would have canoes. They would, and the entrepreneurs and explorers and others would use the rivers, and early settlers would settle near the river. They needed water. They needed the lumber from the forest. And so you can imagine people coming up that corridor when it was a meander and settling in St. Joe. So there's settlement history there. Now you walk along the corridor and you start to realize that there's trees. Those trees are not native to the prairie. They're what we refer to as crud trees. They're trees that grow very fast, and they settle on areas that are well drained, and the railroad lines are well drained. And so those trees grow there. But if you watch, you can see things like dock and blue stem and the remnant prairie plants still are living in the area. it's fun to realize that in 1905, or when the electricity got to be malleable and people could work with it, there's the interurban. And the interurban is relatively intact because the interurban was run by electricity, and the catenaries that were on the allowed the electricity to be contacted to the tram or trolley car that was using them, and electricity was provided through the towns that they came to. So you can see the poles are still there. This was owned by Illinois Power, and now is owned by Ameren. And that's another thing for stewards to realize. And they can get to see areas where there is mowing to allow water to move to culverts. There are little wetlands. The road on the other side of Placement Road is alive with prairie when it's not mown. The mowing is excessive. If you were a steward that was interested in local politics, you would go to the township supervisor and beg him not to mow that corridor. But mowing has become a sociological thing. If you don't mow your land, you can be fined for not mowing your lawn. We have people in Urbana who have allowed their lawns to grow, and there's a city ordinance that will tack a note on your door and charge you so much for mowing the lawn. And that can or cannot be a prairie, not if you just let things grow in a city like that, but that's always the chance that the road commissioner will be doing a good, in inverted commas, job when mowing the corridor that is on the other side of the road. It's singularly unfortunate that there's a gaming, a physical playground for, I think it's a area for basketball and baseball and other things. It's right adjacent across the road. So then you would have to be careful to explain to the township supervisor that this was also their heritage, and that a little prairie there would be good. This is another thing that you can talk about. You have volunteers, and you're going to take out some invasive olive and some invasive honeysuckle, and you might leave some weedy species that are good pollinators. Bull thistles are often removed, but they are good pollinators, and there are native thistles. And there are plants like New Jersey tea that indicate that this is indeed a remnant. There's been a temptation to take down the trees that grew, much to the chagrin of people who love trees and don't love prairies. At one stage, the Forest Preserve was having to hire the trail developers were having to hire a 1,000-horsepower machine that would chip 3 or 4 inch trees in demolish. And that, when it was disappeared, there was a real sad situation for many people who like to feel free and at home with trees. But the trees are those deep-rooted and strong-rooted trees that are not as fibrous and as healthy as a prairie. So my feeling is that the disappearance of the crud trees is a good affair. At one stage, I complimented the Forest Preserve on removing the trees. And the response was that I was the only person who had suggested that that was an ideal thing to do. All these things are there. There's a burn pile. They took the trees and put them in a pile and burned. Now, if you're going to burn a prairie with lightning strike, it's going to be a scudgy prairie. It burns the top of the soil. Most of the prairie energy and activity is underground. Buds that provide new growth are going to be right under there. And the scudgy fire will be high temperature, 4 feet above, but do little damage to the prairie. In fact, they release seed. Some seeds don't open unless they're through with a burn fire. They've been so many years getting used to this process that they take advantage of it, and they need a fire to burst the seed open, and so it grows. Some of the vegetation provides nutriment. We talked a little bit about Luce, but under the Luce there is glacial till, and it's alive with glacial material that's come from Canada, the Laurentian Shield, and gradually over thousands of years, that soil has ground. It has been ground by glaciers. And if you pick up a rock, you can often see it striated where it's been moved along with the ice. So it's forming soil. And that soil is what you can see on that remnant. If you walk on it, it's softer than if you walk on a field. The field may be 10 inches lower because it's not only lost its humus, but it's compacted. And you have to then fertilize it. It's like growing a bean seed in a petri dish. You have to provide it with food. So the wonderful soil that was our prairie has been overused to the point that we're almost treating it as a laboratory plant that needs nitrogen and phosphorus and sulfur to grow. You have to imagine that in that humus there are millions and millions of bacteria and protozoa and fungi and all manner of microorganisms, and we've lost them. So this little piece of corridor is wonderful. The interurban came when there was a little bit more development, probably had a cornfield or two up to the mainline, but it hasn't been devastated to the same extent. It's been somewhat protected by the railroad, the cheaper, lightweight railroad just between towns. And that's wonderful adjunct prairie. The question is, should we take those invasive trees and burn them on the remnant prairie? My answer is no, because that sterilizes the soil for many years. The bacteria and fungi will come back in, and the program will, give it another 100 years or 1,000 years, it'll come back, but we don't need to do that. So then the next question is, can we put the trees that have seeds on them on the interurban? Well, being myself, I'd say, hell no. What do we, our evil intent is to take that interurban and worked with Ameren, who is the power line owner, and say to them, can we allow your prairie that's on your line and so to grow? And we will promise you that we won't have trees that will short to the power lines. If you have a power line that is older and you have more people and you want to put more power through it, it's going to resist and it's going to expand and it's going to drop down a little and can hit a tree. A prairie doesn't do that. It's further away. And even if it does burn, it's a scrunchy burn, not a real heavy burn with forest trees. So that you can look at as you walk along the prairie. You can see where the Policeman's Road has a little right angle access to 150. And that area has been mown. It's an area that carries prairie. The prairie does very well, thank you. Why the devil do you need to mow it? We need to get away from this neatness syndrome, which denies the plants. And then when you go around the corner, you get an extension of the prairie. And there must have been perhaps a little outlier of forest there because the soil is a little more clay. And the question is, where should you put the seed that you pick from the remnant prairie? I would put it in that sort of location where it's friends and relatives are there. And that area between there and the section road to the west, just a few hundred yards away from the Policeman's Prairie, there is more remnants all the way from the section road to Falls and Elevator. You can see it in the distance. But if you run in on that section road and park on the interurban, as you can do, there was a very healthy growth of prairie. It was so healthy that yellow ribbons were placed around it so that people could salvage it. It was salvaged. That doesn't mean that you take everything, but you can replant. And those prairie plants will regrow. And the soil that you take with it will have seed in it. So when the salvage was finished, that area was scraped. It was scraped all the way, 1 mile, one section road, to Falls Elevator. And that is taken the humus off. And some of that humus has been taken to the Homer Lake, and there it grows. But what's left behind can use your seed. You have to be careful to put the seed in on the prairie. The roadside is seeded with roadside species that grow quickly and often invasive. We would hope that that didn't happen, but there's often a use of white and yellow clover, which is a pasture plant, because it produces, takes nitrogen from the air and converts it into nitrogenous materials, which contribute to the humus and provide nutrients. And that material is absent now. And you are hoping to spend 1,000 years putting it back. And so you seed your seed from the remnant prairie that's been more gently treated to the roadside expansion and the drainage that's alongside. On the interurban, often called IT, Illinois Traction Company, it had a lot of the interurban, so that's why they got to call IT. The interurban has been taken for a drainage ditch, and the drainage ditch is really quite well established was Savills of Prairie here and there. It has lost some of its topsoil, but the topsoil has been undisturbed for many years. You do have a problem with farmers who would like to farm the retired interurban and come in from power pole to power pole and get a few more grains of agriculture. That we would hope would cease, but someone in that stewardship group might be tickled by the idea that we might work with Ameren to establish prairie from Urbana to Oakwood, a little piece that is disturbed to some extent. But folks, that's all we have. And we enjoy having a wide trail for American Disability Act people and for EPA trying to cap potential creosote that was in the ballast. But we have to somehow scratch these people's backs enough for them to want to keep the vegetation. And please don't herbicide it. Not even spot herbicide it. Remove the invasive trees mechanically. If they get to be in too many trees, they will blanket spray. And but they have equipment, chainsaws and axes that can remove it. The promise of an easement might be that the easement owners would be responsible for the removal of any tree that grows along that corridor. And it provides an interest that's much more generous than just having one more row of corn and soybeans. It might be more than one more row, but it... So we're hoping that that corridor could be utilized. The railroad goes through St. Joe. If you are a surveillance person, you wish you could drive a 5-ton truck for the whole length, but often people put bridges in that are narrower than they need to be for continuous surveillance. So the bridge over the Salt Fork is just a little narrow and just a little light for a surveillance vehicle to go across. So they have to come back out the Priestman's Road onto 150 and across the straightened road through St. Joe and back into the other side of the bridge if they're going to surveil it. We've had this happen in many rail trails where cheap bridges have been put in and sometimes the surveillance trucks had to go 12 miles to get back to the other side. So on the east side is another portion of interest. And I'll have to do that another time because we're coming to the end of the hour. And thank you for WEFT and thank you for Urbana Public Television. And this is Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WEFT, Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. And if you get with Elizabeth, go out and do some volunteering, but ask about the history.
And I always like to let you know that if your organization has an upcoming fundraiser or wish to provide a service to the community, and be it a music or art event, workshop, or educational seminar, simply send a short script to WEFT at psa@weft.org, and we'll be sure to include it in our on-air public service announcements. You can also drop a flyer off here at the station or mail it to WEFT, 113 North Market Street, Champaign, Illinois, 61820.
Listening to the radio station where the mighty host of heaven sing.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio
on. Turn your radio on.
If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of the endless spring.
Let's get it going! Hi, this is Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, and you're listening to 90.1 FM Champaign, WEFT.